Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. Our last episode was about Hereditary and Midsommar, Ari Aster doubleheader. Before that, we did Spike Lee's Five Bloods, Modern Times, the Charlie Chaplin film before that, and Copland, and Bo Burnham's Make Happy. I also wrote a book that you can get on Amazon. It's called Content About Content. It is a collection of essays about various pop culture topics that you can read if you like. And if you don't like supporting Amazon, get at me on Twitter, at the MacGuffin Man, and I will just send it to you. All right, let's start the episode. All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are.
Here we are talking about another highly anticipated film.
Yeah. Yes. It's really like the streets were going nuts over the new Charlie Kaufman. At the grocery store earlier today. People couldn't stop talking about it. It was wild.
Highly anticipated by certain people, for sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Highly anticipated by a vocal minority.
Yes, but he's a critically respected filmmaker and isn't very prolific, I'd say. And it had been a while since we got a brand new film of his directed by him. Mm-hmm. And it came to us in the form of I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, like most filmmakers, he's more prolific than we think, but he can only get money for very occasionally. You know, he's still trying to make films and just failing, as so many filmmakers do constantly.
Yeah.
Like his colleague Spike Jonze's last movie, Her, came out in what, like 2013? You know, I don't think it's for a lack of a desire of Spike Jonze wanting to make another movie.
No, it's true. And we would have talked about this on probably The Irishman too. But even people, I mean, and Scorsese's, you know, more mainstream fare than Charlie Kaufman would be. These directors that we talk about as, you know, being well regarded still do have a hard time putting the money together. And even on this one, this film was based on a book by Ian Reid of the same title. And he said, like, Charlie Kaufman is very straightforward in saying, I was looking to find something to adapt because I thought it would be easier to get money for something that already existed and something I could point to and say that this is the source material and people receive the source material well, so give me some money. So, as I said, he's very critically well-regarded, but Hollywood's still a business, and this is how we went about making it, and my understanding is that while it's not a complete departure from the book, it's certainly a lot different, especially in the second half.
Yeah, and I think like one of the big choices that the movie makes is making it much, or introducing the janitor a lot earlier, in that it introduces the janitor in like minute two, whereas there was a reveal in the book, is my understanding. But it sounds like neither of us have read that book, so we probably won't talk too much about the book, you know, focusing on the movie. But yes, it does sort of, once the animated pig shows up, you're like definitely fully into Charlie Kaufman territory, you know, like, I mean, I guess the animated pig shows up pretty early on, but like, and starts walking, you know, not the billboard version of the animated pig.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And,
naked humans talking about death, talking to animated animals, you know, this is very Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah. I was going to say that, a lot of the hallmarks are here pretty early on.
Yeah.
And as someone who's a big fan of his, you know, that's fine by me. And I think that if you don't like his other stuff, you're not going to like this. I don't think it's necessarily derivative of other things he's done. But, you know who's making this movie. And, as I said, if his kind of thing works for you, you'll probably like this. You can't say for sure. But this is going to rub a lot of people the wrong way, and I wasn't one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's derivative of his own work in the way that any filmmaker's new movie is derivative of their previous work, and that they just sort of come from the same same brain, and just inherently humans are interested in the same things over and over again, you know, individuals are. And this is a perfect example of that. He's interested in the human body, he's interested in popular media, he's interested in entropy, and he's interested in pissing people off. And I think he does all these things in this film.
Yeah. And this, you know, this has some of that, I guess we can term it psychological horror that we've seen in his other work. And something that I think goes through so much of his work and is definitely front and center here and kind of talked about explicitly is just this notion of subjectivity. And he'll talk about that a lot in interviews and say things like he wouldn't know how to make a movie that's not subjective because all of us are experiencing the world subjectively. So that's, you know, that's the lens he chooses to tell stories through. But, you know, through so many different ways, you see that this is someone's subjective experience. And, you know, I'm only slowing up there because this movie does not make sense. So, you know, like, it's kind of hard to talk about this as one linear experience for reasons that, you know, if you've seen the movie, you understand, and reasons we'll talk about, I'm sure. But this isn't just a, you know, a straightforward narrative telling of something that happened to 2 or 4 or 10 people. It's so inextricably twisted in with someone's subjective experience that I'm just gonna have a hard time. We're just both gonna have a hard time talking about this like we would talk about, you know, a straightforward narrative film.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I guess the question then I think we should start with is like, what element of this movie had you the most interested the first time you watched it? And like, what was your experience watching it the first time? Like, what was the thing that jumped out at you and was like, oh, cool. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first time through you're really even right to the very end, trying to make sense of what's happening. And if you have your own theory of what's happening, there seems to be no way to really pin this movie down. And so, I mean, what struck me going through the first time is still trying to get a grip on what it is you're actually looking at, and you know who's telling the story. Even just basic things like I don't know where this is taking place, you know, geographically. I don't know when this is taking place. Yeah.
My theory is that it takes place in the state of Oklahoma.
I think it's because they say the word Oklahoma a few times.
Well, it's also, I think, when Oklahoma comes up and Jake is talking about the school putting it on every few years, he says something along the lines of for obvious reasons, which I feel like is as much of a definitive answer as Charlie Kaufman's ever going to give you about anything. So.
Yeah, but then I wonder what big city they're going to and from in a day. But anyway, that's probably inconsequential. Yeah, and so it's still, you know, along with, just finding myself engaged, trying to wrap my head around what I'm looking at, what's happening. It's still just being peppered with all the tension that you can get. You know, I mentioned some of that psychological horror that's obviously present. And then we have a lot of good actors doing good acting, and we have some twisted but great comedy, and I just think Charlie Kaufman is so funny when he chooses to be, and some things miss, like anyone trying to do comedy, but the way he's willing, the way he's able to balance these very tense moments in this darkness and these very personal, intimate moments with humor, the way that I think, you know, reflects real life in a way that those funny things can come out of nowhere and be things that kind of feel inappropriate to find funny at a time. And, you know, this movie is very hard to explain and also very easy to explain. You know, it's pretty nebulous, but it's also pretty straightforward. It is a couple going to meet the boyfriend's parents. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a long drive and then they go to a house and then it's another long drive and they go to his high school. Gets kind of fuzzier near the very end. Yeah. But, you know, in a way it is a story of not a lot happening and spending a lot of time with these people and listening I feel fully rounded people converse for so much of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. The first time watching this movie, like I think the thing that jumped out at me was the like media criticism element of it, which I think he really leaned into more in this movie than he has in anything previously. The idea of us being shaped by popular culture, and part of it is that that's a through line through a lot of his novel Antkind, which came out in the summer, which I read. And but like watching I'm Thinking of Ending Things for the first time, I sort of I guess it's about like an hour and 30 minutes in or so when you start to figure out that basically everything is happening in one human brain's head. And it's like when the woman who I will refer to as Lucy
Yeah, I think that's wise.
is looking through Jake's childhood bedroom, his bookshelf specifically, and you start to see things that have come up earlier. And when they get in the car shortly after that, it becomes even more clear because she does her Pauline Kael quotation, and they're
Yeah,
talking about a woman under the influence.
she does read a poem in a book by someone else that she's, I guess, under the impression that she wrote earlier. So at that point, what logic is left in this movie is really out the window.
Yeah, exactly. But the things that become more noticeable, like like say the poem, yeah, when she's saying that poem, I have no idea who Ava, I forget what the word,
HD, yeah.
HD, okay, I was gonna say HD, but I was like, high definition, but like I don't know that poem. Like you can tell me it's written by anybody. You can tell me it's written by Jesse Buckley. You can tell me it's written by Lucy. You can tell me it's written by Charlie Kaufman. You know, and then we get more time passes, and you start to get to the bigger and bigger works that are being referenced. In, A Woman Under the Influence, John Cassavetes, Pauline Kael, David Foster Wallace comes up in that same conversation. You get A Beautiful Mind, and like. That's when it really started to become really interesting to me. I will say, like, I found the movie kind of cloying until I started to clue into what it actually was. Like, I enjoyed it, but it sort of seemed like a retread of certain things from Charlie Kaufman's previous work, and in a way that I didn't think added enough new stuff. And that's sort of where when the turn sort of starts to come, it just sort of became very much territory for me, you know, like, and I still enjoyed it, but it was sort
Directly
of,
quoting Pauline Kael for extended periods of
well,
time.
yeah, but also like, I don't know, it was sort of it's hard to describe because it's not like I dislike this movie, but it was sort of, I don't know, until you sort of really start to clue into what's happening. And I, from what I've been reading, I think I clued into the whole janitor thing a bit earlier than most people did, but only like 5 minutes earlier, but still. But before you sort of find that, I don't know, it's just sort of, it just felt like what I've seen before. And I think that's kind of the great trick of this movie is that, and again, another classic Charlie Kaufman fuck you is that I thought it was one thing and started to grow tired of it. And then he was like, no, you're wrong. You know, this is great and you love this. And I'm like, yep, you know what? I do. So it's just sort of, it was so reliant on that turn. And the fact that I never gave up on the movie was based entirely around me having faith in Charlie Kaufman's ability to grow as a human being. Because that first shot you see of Jesse Buckley, like in the brightest clothes you've ever seen, literally catching snowflakes in her mouth, like falling snowflakes. And it's just like she's doing two armed waves. And I'm like, oh my God, not Kate Winslet again. And
Eternal
which,
Sunshine, yeah.
yeah, exactly. Which is, yeah, exactly. Like I've said, it's amazing. I like Eternal Sunshine as much as I do, despite every character in that movie being an impossible archetype. But like, that sort of personal growth, and him being able to toy with our pre-existing expectations based on his own movies, I thought that was cool, and I think it says a lot for him that I was willing to give him a pass for a full 90 minutes, you know,
Yeah. Well,
on
I
that
want
sort of
to
stuff.
kind of
And
take a
also,
double
Jesse
take.
Buckley gets credit for that as well.
Yeah, sure. No, yeah. All the Jesse is fantastic.
Yes.
yeah, I want to dig into something you said where you know, there's that turn where you kind of it becomes more engaging. And it's around the time you know, you start considering the janitor for who he is. But I don't think that, I know, I'm not saying this what you're saying, but I don't think that this relies on it being a twist movie. You know, it's not like,
no.
It's there's all this build up and then there's a twist and then that pays off everything else. Mm-hmm. He's even said it's not supposed to be like an M. Night Shyamalan. This is the thing that will change the perspective of everything and is kind of the payoff moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what you mean, because the first time watching through the kind of the first, 90 minutes of this movie, you know, with certain exceptions, it just doesn't feel like it's new enough, at least, you know, not that there's nothing new here, but that it's not a big leap forward as you're kind of hoping for with a filmmaker that you like.
Mm-hmm. Also the way that the car shot stuff was shot, that sort of like, that took me, I don't know. It was like green screen prison car. That was a problem for me, but sorry, I interrupted.
Okay.
But yeah, that was a big thing for me.
We could talk about the car because, again, that's about 45 minutes of this movie. Mm-hmm. Just that notion of subjectivity in that we get them obscured by the snow on the windows. You know, we get the camera outside of the car more often than I think would be traditional in cinema language. You know, you'd have some establishing shots, maybe some reminders of outside, but not as much. And you get the wind and the sound mix. And it just seems to me that, you know, these long moments where, you know, these people know each other for 7 weeks. And as Jake has said, a road trip's a really great way to, you know, get to know somebody. And it seems like this is a great chance for them to get to know each other and for them, for their identities to be further revealed. But the way that it's shot and the sound is mixed, it just seems to obscure them more. And that this moment of them kind of becoming more clear to each other is doing the opposite. You know, we're just understanding them less, and it just doesn't seem like we are, in a subtle way, it's being communicated to us that we're not being let into the true nature of these characters the way that you would expect a long drive to, you know, reveal these characters to each other, and whether it's for better or worse, you know, it ends up they're right for each other, it ends up they're wrong for each other, which, you know, the opening narration and the title of this movie, you know, leads you to believe that this is a movie about a relationship that's not working out and might end within the runtime. And again, in an odd sort of way, it does, but not in the straightforward fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. So what do we talk about first? Like, where do we go to now? Do we just sort of run down the four characters and talk about them individually? That seems easier.
I mean, you can't, just because you kind of touched on it too, I'll bring up something, you know, the way that you feel about Eternal Sunshine. I do hear the criticisms, of Charlie Kaufman, and I think that most of them are on point. You know, even though I love this, I really like this movie a lot. The like student film angle makes a ton of sense to me. You know, I totally see that. These narrations of what can sometimes be pretty maudlin feelings about, you know, a relationship. I hear all that stuff, and I kind of can't shake off all of it entirely, but just from having done so many other things so well, as a whole, I still think it's a resounding success.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think most filmmakers who I love, the repetitive criticisms of them are founded, you know, like, I think it's true of, I mean, Charlie Kaufman clearly loves David Lynch. I think criticisms of David Lynch are founded, and they're just criticisms I don't care, you know, like, I just like the movie enough that I don't care. And I mean, Eternal Sunshine is sort of a unique case in that that movie is not solely written by Charlie Kaufman. And I think the greatness of that movie kind of lies halfway in between Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry, in that they're both, judging them from their other work, they're both radically different people. In that Charlie Kaufman seems a lot more cynical than Michel Gondry, and I think that the movie sort of comes out of a conversation between the two of them. That you know, I don't love any of Eternal or any of Michel Gondry's other work as much as I love Eternal Sunshine, but I like other Charlie Kaufman things more than I like Eternal Sunshine. You know what I mean? So I think that it's sort of the things I don't like about Eternal Sunshine, I think we can blame on Michel Gondry, but also I like that Charlie Kaufman's aware that he's his name is attached to that, and Clementine's the most obvious example, but it's not like Cameron Diaz and being John Malkovich seems like a real woman, you know, like so, you know, it's just woman characters in Charlie Kaufman movies in general. But
yeah. Okay, well, let's start with Lucy. And again, I'll point out for the last time, it's going to be tough to talk about these people. I think Lucy's probably the most difficult because it is this amalgamation of, I think, past experiences and fantasy, and just in the very nature of her character being self-contradictory, the way that a lot of this movie is. Mm-hmm. It, you know, that's always sort of a factor here, but, mm-hmm. You know, I think it's great. I think it must have been a very difficult role to play. I still think Jesse Buckley makes the character of Lucy extremely compelling, you know, despite that hoop to jump through. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we can start with her because despite this being kind of all taking place in Jake's mind, seemingly, I do think it is Lucy that is the star, if anybody is.
Yeah, exactly. And we're introduced to her first, and we get the overture of her thoughts, you know, the that sort of opening couple of minutes where it's just shots of wallpaper in different places along the house or around the house, the swing set, all these things, while her vocal or her voiceover is being played. I'm thinking of ending things and talking about ideas and all these things. Yeah, she's the person we were meant to attach to, and then we sort of start to figure out as the movie goes along that everything that we assumed in the opening minute is unraveling. And Jesse Buckley is great as an actor, and I think the way that the movie sort of changes her as we get closer into the family structure, like the way that she, once they get to the house, there's various stages of being at the house. You know, you have your dinner, you have your dessert. Then she goes upstairs. Later she goes downstairs and then they leave, you know, it's like she's getting to new stages of this relationship, even though at the beginning she's already thinking about maybe I'm thinking of ending things. Yes. And like that also there's two sides to that coin, just on the relationship level, in that she's thinking of breaking up with Jake, but there's also the idea of meeting your partner's parents is also like, I'm ending the idea of me not being attached to this person, you know, like, yeah. It's like, I'm ending my loneliness by being with this person. And I think that's something that, or hopefully ending my loneliness by choosing to be with this person, because that is like, what's one of the biggest steps you can come up with in a relationship? It's meeting their parents, you know, like of an early stages of a relationship, you know? And I think that all of the time in the home is so much, even when she's not physically exploring the home, is so much her exploring and learning about the home that she is committing to, or thinking of committing to being a part of, you know? We see Jake treat her, the conversation of the four characters is going to happen simultaneously is what I'm figuring out as I'm trying to explain this. But, you know, we see that conversation where Toni Collette, the mother, is talking about the genius edition of Trivial Pursuit, and she's saying genius, and Jake is getting very angry at her and, like, literally hits the table and yells and corrects her. And this seems to be a trend with Jake throughout the movie of correcting people. And it's like, cool. Sorry?
And just losing his, like, having a temper and kind of losing his cool.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, that's not a good way to react to a human being. And, like, least of all your mother. But then almost immediately after that, they start doing their... Lucy starts talking about the story of them meeting at a trivia night. And she is, like, making mistakes in retelling of facts, and he is correcting her, but he's correcting her in a much quieter, more polite way. And I think the implication there is that this is how he corrects her now, but what we just saw with the genius edition is how he'll correct her in the future. And, like, just all of these, as you spend more time with the woman with the red hair, you start to treat her like somebody, the woman you have already spent a lot of time with. You know what I mean? And certainly doesn't paint Jake as a good human being at all. And I think it rightfully gives Lucy some worries. And it's sort of like the whole period of being in the house is her sort of learning about both where Jake came from and kind of what to expect in the future, you know? And it's sort of, like you said, it doesn't really take place at a time. It takes place all the time, you know, like in their entire history. And it takes place before Lucy and Jake ever met. It takes place after they'll theoretically break up, you know, like, and that whole, the whole sequence at the house is at some points more obvious than others. Just Lucy exploring the life that she is thinking of committing to.
And kind of experiencing that, you know, however many years of whatever their domestic situation would be. Yeah, and I'll just say when you're talking about, you know, you kind of get to know this Lucy character, and then your understanding of her develops, and you know she's sort of more amorphous than what you know, what you come to expect from any character in, I'll say, a normal film, that it slips away. And that's sort of this experience that I think Jake is kind of reliving over and over, is what is a similar experience that the viewer gets, that you know, it seems to be a recollection and kind of a reimagining, something of a time loop all simultaneously. And I think that's one of the things I was trying to get at when I said it's not like a Shyamalan twist where one thing clicks and then everything falls into place. You know, it's still way too slippery. I still don't, you know, understand what's happening, but it seems pretty intentional that there isn't a way to say exactly what has happened. And you know, Charlie Kaufman will even say, like, I kind of invite a lot of different readings, and nothing's ever perfectly clear.
Yeah, when actors would ask him, "What is this movie about?" he would say, "I don't know." You know, like, so.
Yeah, and so that it seems like it is sort of this recollection of things, but also you get the sense that he can't even control this fantasy that, or this recollection, whatever you want to call it. The way that there isn't internal logic, the way that, you know, Lucy seems to be getting calls from herself and these very ominous voicemails, it just doesn't seem like, even if it's inside Jake's mind or Jake the janitor's mind or you know, however you want to phrase it, that it's still not under his control. That I think that's part of someone who thinks about women in this way, and this kind of gets cleared up a bit when we see Lucy walking down the stairs over and over. That you know, if your idea of a woman is just someone to reinforce your confidence or to, you know, support you, that's not a real person. That's not a rounded person. And so when you want this kind of loving, good, equal relationship, but you're not willing to, you know, give the other person that side of it, it kind of folds in on itself. And this wasn't something I thought of while watching it, but it was something just kind of in thinking about it and using the language I got. And here's the you know, token Nolan mentioned, but I think it was something kind of like making a world in Inception, you know, like there has to be this internal logic to it. And when that starts falling apart, the world starts falling apart and things start getting violent, ugly. And I think that that's a lot of what this movie is. You know, it's not just this rosy colored glasses look on the past, because you know, there's so much negativity and uncomfortable tension, and you know, Jake's the butt of jokes, and you know, as we said, loses his temper in, you know, his fantasy. That doesn't make sense, but I think it's just pointing to these inconsistent ideas that this man at least seems to have about what he wants in a partner, but when all he really wants is self-serving, that's not, you know, that loop never really closes.
Yes. And I sort of like, I even take it, I don't know, I take it even like further back. Like, I think there's two sort of things happening simultaneously, and that he is sort of Jake, or this sort of like whatever head this is happening in, janitor man, whatever, is simultaneously reconsidering everything that happened in his personal life, and also wondering why he thinks about things the way that he does, and always coming back to the conclusion of it's things he read and things that he watched. And I think that is something that's really important to me in understanding how this movie, one, it's an interesting sort of like magic trick in getting out of any criticisms of women portrayed in your movie, in that we are like, everybody takes this movie as something that's happening in a man's head, it seems like, you know, by the end of the movie, partially because the janitor is a man, you know, and it just sort of, by the end of the movie, it's like anything you want to say about the male gaze is correct. And he's saying that, yeah, in this way, because of media and the way that media have portrayed both women, people in general, and the human life, you know, and also romance, you know, and we see all of those things in media, and then we see all of those things from his parents, you know, we see the most foundational thing for you is like a biological being, and then the most foundational thing for you is like an ideological being, you know, somebody who is in your bedroom consuming all of these things that will end up forming your mind without realizing that watching The Rock 15 times as a 12-year-old is going to make you like action movies for the rest of your life, despite the fact that maybe that's a problematic impulse, you know? And I think those things are happening simultaneously. And I think that's how we get a lot of the, there's just the more gazy moments, you know, where we're just sort of staring at a woman and idealizing her. And I think one of my favorite moments in this movie is when, or just being very confident in your own opinions, is after Lucy, after Lucy reads the poem, the Bone Dog, it's called, and she says, or Jake's reaction is, it's like you wrote it about me, you know, and she's already broken the fourth wall while she's reading a handful of lines toward the end of the poem, but as she like moves her head back to just switch up her seating position after he says that, she gives a quick glance to the camera that isn't like, it's not an eye roll, but it's also obviously an eye roll, you know, and it, like, if you're not looking for it, it's hard, you're not going to see it, but it's very just like, this is a vain,
get out of this guy. Yeah.
Exactly. This is a vain person who thinks all art is about him, you know, and we are people who have had a podcast for 10 years talking about art and how it reflects upon us as human beings. And I don't know. I think that parallel needs to be pointed out, but I think that there are elements throughout this movie that paint Jake as a non-ideal human being, even without him being loud and violent, that I think are just absolutely crucial to engaging with this movie at all.
But to go back to her reading of that poem there, and he says, it's like you wrote it about me, which I think you're absolutely right to point out the self-centeredness of that. And I mean, I just think that, like so many things in this movie, that it functions in two ways. And I think, you know, it would take too long to list everything that was probably has a double meaning in this movie, because that's kind of one of his best tricks. But I think there's the sense that it's about me, as in, you know, it's about living with me, because it sounds like, you know, if it's these two people and the poet is coming home and saying how awful it is to come home, there's kind of that sense that he's feeling attacked, like, oh, it's about me, that all this negative stuff is, you know, just this artistic cheap shot at saying it's I'm not a good person to spend time with if coming home is this bad. But it could also be of his viewpoint. If this is, you know, near the end of his life, janitor Jake, all these lines about coming home to the same house and, you know, you've resigned to, you know, endless identical days or whatever the exact line is. It can be looked at in a different way when we kind of learn more what we think the true nature of this story being told and who's telling it and, you know, when and how they're telling it. just sort of imbues that line and so much of that poem with more than one meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the house idea of seeing the future, because I think it's also like it's his. So that poem is, you know, he's sort of viewing it as about himself, and Lucy is as well, like just the idea of all the days are the same, but all the days are different versions of the same for every human being, you know, like that's sort of just something that everybody has to come to grips with at some point, you know. So that's sort of one of the more universal things about it. And the tying back into the whole Lucy looking around the house and seeing her future and her past and all these things. I love the scene when she goes into Jake's childhood bedroom, because you know, she sees.
No, it's his childhood bedroom.
Sorry?
How do you know it's his childhood bedroom?
Good question. I'll have to look in my notes to find out for sure. But the way, like when she's looking over his bookshelf, and if we haven't mentioned it already, like that the book is open to the Bone Dog poem. And she's seeing various pieces of media that will be discussed later in the film as well. And, you know, she's seeing what turned Jake into what he is today. And then her father comes in and gives her a look at the future. And there, from that point, it's just like it's bouncing pretty fast in between different time periods in the her learning about Jake and learning about her own future and or past, who knows. In that we see her basically go downstairs, we see her watch Toni Collette die, she gets yelled at, in that the idea being that like when she meets her parents, there's time between when she meets Jake's parents and when Jake's mom dies, you know, like there's a period of time, and in that time period enough time has passed for him to be more violent in his anger when he's fed up. And that's another time passing thing. And it's just all these things combining into this, like, I don't know, this weird sort of formless thing that it's impossible to put into words, basically. You know, it's just this weird experience about time passing and learning about yourself, and then trying to figure out what turned you into that. And I think that's what the second car conversation is them just being more transparent about what got them to that point and what got them to that conversation, what built them into who they are. And then they just are more honest, but also more obtuse, because that's how Charlie Kaufman works.
Yeah. Yeah, and more honest in the sense that, you know, we've seen the spine of a Pauline Kael book now, and now we get an extended Pauline Kael impression and, you know, a verbatim retelling of her opinion of a certain film. And yeah, I think that you're right about that it, that's less revealing of who Lucy is in a way, if once you know that this is just literally somebody else's writing, but also more honest in that, you know, people are, you know, reflections of what they've done and what they've read, and it just seems that this is something that was important to Jake, and so it's important to, you know, Jake's understanding of what a woman should be, seemingly.
Yeah, well, and I think I think something that's really important about that scene is, one, they're talking about a woman under the influence, and that's a John Cassavetes movie. It's one of John Cassavetes' most famous movies, and he was famous, like, he's a pioneer of independent cinema, American independent cinema. He's also a pioneer of, like, cinema verite style filmmaking. Basically, if you watch anything, like, any American movie, any Hollywood movie with handheld camera work, it's, like, partially influenced by the Maisels brothers, and it's partially influenced by John Cassavetes, you know, like, at a very broad stroke sort of thing. And Cassavetes would make movies with a collection of his friends, and they would make them with money he made from being an actor. And he really was an actor's director, in that he sort of wanted them to sort of feel out the performances, right? And A Woman Under the Influence is sort of this textbook example of that sort of style, in that it's very much an actor's movie. Most of it takes place in one house, with the exceptions of when Peter Falk, whose character's name I don't remember, he is Mabel's husband, when he's at work or taking the kids to the beach, whatever. But it's a very interior film, And the main focus of the movie is Mabel and her struggle with mental health, and just the way that it's shot is very clearly like an actor's movie, and it's sort of playing out in this sort of, again, verite style, even though I don't know if the term verite existed in 1974 when it was released. And I think something that's interesting about that is that, like, structurally, that movie isn't super different from I'm Thinking of Ending Things, in that it's a small movie. It's small to the point that Cassavetes initially wanted to put it on as a play, but the woman who plays Mabel, Jenna Rollins, who's also Cassavetes' wife, convinced him that it would be much too difficult to put on as a play because it's the emotions of it are just too difficult for actors to be doing every night. And which, after seeing her performance, like, it's pretty clear. And Pauline Kael's review focuses on the idea that this movie doesn't feel realistic, and that Jenna Rollins' performance is too over the top, and which is honestly like a criticism I kind of agree with, but it's also like, I can't watch that movie in 1974, you know? So it's like, that might have been a new super cool acting style in 1974, but it also is something that just seems over the top now.
Sure.
But Pauline Kael was on it immediately, you know? And Pauline Kael is an amazing writer who has written many, many things that I don't agree with, but I always love reading because she's reading her because she's just such a fantastic writer. And I think the point of this movie's use of that review, which isn't actually in the book, the Pauline Kael book that we see, but it is definitely a Pauline Kael review. Her criticism of Jenna Rollins' performance is like her criticism of any media that is meant to portray reality. Like, it's all a construction. And even when you're making the construction that pretends to be more real than something that's more grand, like a Sidney Pollack movie from around the same time, you know, like a more Hollywood version, like his version of The Great Gatsby, say. The Cassavetes thing is still a lie. A woman under the influence is still a lie, and that's what she's taking issue with. Whereas I think the idea is supposed to be that something like I'm Thinking of Ending Things is like, yeah, we're a construction, we're open about it. And the whole Jake aspect of it is that he sympathizes with Mabel, who is Jenna Rollins' character, who Pauline Kael is talking about, and who Lucy imitates earlier in the movie, in the first part of the car ride. But it's him saying, I identify with Mabel, and then Lucy immediately being like, oh no, you're wrong, this is this, I stand by this opinion. And Pauline Kael was a very forceful, I believe in what I'm saying, and it's pretty hard to disagree with me because I'm Pauline Kael sort of writer. And Jake's reaction is to sort of just get quiet and shrink into himself. Like, he realizes that he's wrong, he's incorrect, or he doesn't view himself as the authority on this. And it just sort of like shuts him down. And then he immediately wants Tulsi down. Like, he wants a sweet confection to sort of make him feel better.
From his child.
Yeah, exactly. Also from his childhood, but something that goes down easy, at least in his head, right? And that sort of leads us to the movie that the janitor watches earlier on, which is like textbook, this is easy to watch. This is something that I've put on. Clearly, he's watching it in pieces because he's watching the end of a movie as he's starting to eat his sandwich, you know, like he's been watching this in 10-minute increments over the course of many breaks, I would guess. And it's just it's a parody of a Hollywood rom-com, something that coincidentally would be found on Netflix. Like, that's something they've been making a lot of recently. And that is the cinematic equivalent of Tulsi Town. It's something that is just sweet and just makes you feel better, if you're willing to give into it. And unlike the Oreo burr that he has like three spoonfuls of and is done with, the older version of him is willing to get to the bottom of the cup or the director's title card at the end, you know? And I think it's just sort of being proven wrong leads him into a retreat almost. And I think this movie is sort of like trying to encourage you to think more about what led you to where you are so that you don't fully retreat into just eating a sandwich and watching fake Robert Zemeckis movies.
Yeah, Robert
Yeah.
Zemeckis.
Also, I had to pause the movie. I laughed so hard when that came up. Like, it's so funny.
it's the kind of joke you don't get a ton of in this movie.
Oh,
Like,
it's
there is
so
joke.
over the top.
Yeah, there are jokes in this movie, but really not like that until that, and probably not even after that.
Well, and it's also extra funny because it's not really a movie Robert Zemeckis would make, but like the feelings of a Robert Zemeckis movie are there, and it's just, I don't know, it's so perfect.
No,
It's like joke of the year for the next 18 years.
it's not like if it were more cliche, it wouldn't be as funny. It's very fantastic. I just wanted to say that I think it's really important that when he doesn't really disagree, and I think that to tie it into how important subjectivity is to this film, which I think is of paramount importance, it seems like he can't like that movie anymore, and not because someone's disagreed with him, but I think you get the sense that he sees that now, and he sees that he was wrong, as you said, but he can't just disagree and say like that's what you think and this is what I think. I think the wool's been lifted from over his eyes, that he's not like falling for the trick anymore, and he can't unsee it. And that's just part of subjectivity. Like, it's not, this movie is objectively this way, and you can watch it because of someone's viewpoint that's been shared with them. He now sees it that way, and he can never unsee it. It's just, that's the way it is now. He's lost something that he used to enjoy, and that's subjectivity. You can't forget that thing, or you can't look at it as not having that quality that's been revealed to you now. And I think it's really telling that she does that for him, and he can't undo it. And as you pointed out, and I hadn't even thought of that, that is when he needs this childhood treat that's steeped in nostalgia and has a nice jingle and is from his hometown, and it's local near where he grew up, and that's elucidated even further when at the end we see this the cartoon advertisement that he watches through the windshield of his truck, that is, just this totally sweet, artificial 1950s, everybody's happy, and these cartoon characters just have like big cute eyes, and has no reflection on reality, but is good at selling sugary garbage to children.
Yeah, like even the animation style of it, of that ad, seems like something that predates even television. It seems like an animated thing from 1930, even though
Yeah,
like
oh yeah.
there are television advertisement doesn't exist in 1930 because television doesn't exist, So it's so that, I mean, even that as that one moment of playing with time is, like you can't even give us an animation style that makes sense,
Yeah, and I just, the idea of trying to place this time-wise, it kind of sneaks up on you because they're at, you think, okay, he's going to his older parents' farmhouse, and maybe they just don't have newer taste, and but there's nothing really modern about this movie at all. Like, this could have taken place, I don't know the exact model of the car or anything, but for the most part, you just don't see things that are modern. People have, I mean, Lucy has a cell phone, and then other than that, it's really a shot in the dark for the last like 60 years of what we're living through
Yeah,
here. And
exactly.
we
And
have, who knows how much of Lucy is based on women that Jake had any experience with, or maybe it's
oh.
complete fabrication and projection. It could, there could have been a Lucy and a Louisa and an Amy, but this could have been women that he saw at trivia night and never spoke to, but your mind just kind of runs and you picture who these people are, and maybe all these inconsistencies are just because it is a combination of different people, or it's just a combination of fantasies, or as I said, maybe it's just him trying to make internal logic out of a million different lies and that falling through, and that's why she's a poet, but sometimes doesn't know poetry, and sometimes she's a brilliant physicist, and sometimes she, is a painter, and all these different things that, it's, someone could be all of those things, some very smart woman, absolutely, but there are moments where she doesn't know things that someone in that profession would know. Like, it is incoherent at certain points.
Oh, I think I definitely think Lucy is a projection of Jake all the time, like a woman he saw once and then he made up the rest. You know, that's why the opening shot of Lucy is so, and when I say I definitely think that, I mean I definitely think it personally, and as like Charlie Kaufman says, everybody's opinion is different and valid because he made the movie like that. He made the movie for Reddit, basically. And he
It's Westworld if it didn't suck.
Well, I mean, yeah, Reddit movies has sort of turned into its own weird subgenre. Like we watched Us last night, Tenet's Out, which is a Reddit movie. Like there's just this weird trend of very expensive movies being made specifically for a subsection of the internet that's really weird to me, like a subsection that will just dig in very deep. That I mean, we're a part of it. I don't use Reddit, but I have a podcast where we do the same thing, you know,
Yeah,
like
I push back on that a bit, but I don't think now's the time for that debate.
okay. We'll save it for the Tenet podcast.
Yeah.
Lucy, I think Lucy is totally a projection because the way that she's introduced is or sorry, she is on the street corner catching those snowflakes, as I said, and just like even her hairstyle is so hilariously I'm a woman in an indie romance from 2006. Like it's incredible. And I
I
know
was
her
wondering
hair.
if Manic Pixie Dream Girl would come up in this.
I'm trying to avoid saying it because,
Yeah.
but you know, what are you gonna do? Sorry, Scott Tobias. Her and I know her hair changes throughout, but like the first time we see her and for that first car ride, it's just like this is absurd. But like we see her on that street corner or on the curb, waiting for her ride, and then we see who I assume is the janitor watching from above and like sort of creeping her out. And I think that's sort of meant to indicate to us that this is not a woman that he ever knew. This is a woman that he saw from afar and created the rest. And
Okay.
I think something that and then we cut back to Lucy, and then we cut back to the janitor again, but it's Jesse Plemons who's there. You know, it's like very quick, so if you're not looking for it, you don't see it. And he also appears to be in Jake's childhood bedroom. So it's like he is in this room that made him who he is, and he's looking out on the world and he sees a member of this actual world, but he will just create the rest in his own head. And you know, and so I think Lucy's fully a projection all the time, and I think that's why there are gaps in her knowledge, just like there are gaps in anybody's knowledge, because if Jake wants to pretend this person is whatever profession, but he's not also that profession, you know, like he doesn't have the knowledge to even create that knowledge in another human being in his head, you know? So.
And on watching it again, you just I hadn't thought of it in exactly those terms, but you know, she's down on the she's obviously down on street level because she's waiting to get picked up, and you do just kind of get this, you know, big broad man above, you know, this kind of godlike looking down on, and what, you know, as I said, the second time through, once you know, or you know, once you've made your understanding of what the fuck's going on in this movie, you know, you just see him as kind of the puppet master, as someone who is, you know, making all these decisions of who this woman is, and it's out of her control, and that's why there are those inconsistencies you were talking about. And then shortly after that, we see Lucy, you know, look at the mirror in the vehicle that's on the visor, and it's broken, and she can't see herself for who she is. Like, there is no reflection of who you are in this. It's just fragments, and because there is no there. Like, there's no her. There's no self to be looked out at and have a full understanding of, because this is just, you know, whatever. Either pieces of people combined, which works with the fragment thing, or you know, this entire fantasy, all projection, and still there just to be no central person to look out and to be reflected.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is, if I'm like meant to sum up what this movie is about, it is about a person who has led a very interior life, realizing towards the end of their very interior life that every choice they've made is wrong, you know, like reconsidering what led them to that interior life, you know, and what they sort of bought into to create that interior life. And I think the conversation that happens early on about, I forget what they're even talking about that leads to this, but Jake says, you know, I suppose I've watched too many movies, and Lucy responds with, everybody does, it's a societal malady, you know, and the idea that these ideas that these movies get you, like, ideas need a place to live, you know, or ideas want to live. Even shitty movie ideas want to live, you know, and that still takes up a place in your head, you know, if you're willing to let it in there. And I think we see pretty definitively that the janitor is willing to let that in, you know.
Yeah, well, and it's funny you say that of this person living this interior life, because you know, Lucy talks to Jake's parents about him probably being too shy, and you know, his father seems impressed by the story where Jake does kind of make a first move and ask for the number, and we learn from his mother that he didn't have a lot of friends, and he just doesn't seem like the most outwardly social person throughout his whole life. That's mm-hmm. kind of our understanding of him. And so for someone so insular like that and so introverted, there are several moments of him trying to prevent Lucy from having this interior life, like almost to the point where he seems capable of hearing her thoughts. You know, when she's thinking about ending things for extended periods of time, or sometimes a negative thought pops into her head and we can hear that, he'll ask questions as though he knows that, you know, if he lets her linger on her own thoughts and make her own decisions, that he'll be out of her life and therefore that can't happen. You know, he seemingly has this power to know that, to stop it. And you know, several times he says, ta-da, you know, something to stop her when she's in these negative thoughts, and, you know, driving out through these flat farmlands and her not being able to see the house that was right there, you know, you kind of get this sense of this magic that he's still controlling whatever geographical place and has the ability to make these buildings or Jimmy the dog show up at convenient times for him. Mm-hmm. And it's to, you know, rob her of her inner thoughts, which, and, you know, the self that she has inside her head that would make decisions that were wise enough to remove him from her life can't be had by this man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think all I have left is about the last 20 minutes. Do you have anything before then? Seems like we should wrap with the last 20 minutes.
Sure. Yeah. We could talk forever. Let's do the last 20 minutes then.
So there.
Do you want to talk about the visuals at all? It seems like something you might.
Well, it's funny. I remember, like, one of the something that I thought during the movie is, well, one, I know there's no real way to shoot this much car stuff while actually, like, driving around with a camera attached to the car in a heavy snowstorm. Like, it's impossible to do in a way, or sorry, not impossible, but like incredibly difficult to do basically My Dinner with Andre in the style of The Revenant, you know, like it's, yeah. It would be so tough.
Impossible on this budget, we'll say.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Impossible on any sort of any reasonable world where the art has to be financed, you know, like nobody's giving that money to that movie. But I don't even think Charlie Kaufman would want to do it if he could. But just the look of in the cars is just so. And I know the idea is that, like, since everything's not happening, there can be this element of artifice that the movie sort of justifies for itself. But it just doesn't work for me. And I love winter movies. I love that there's a lot of snow in this movie. And it's just like some of the car stuff for so long of them just clearly being. Sitting in a car body in front of a green screen, it's like the performances are great, but it's just like, it's just too much artifice for me to really get sunk in, especially in the first conversation. In the second one, the conversation is more vibrant and it's like more like, oh shit, we're in this, we're rolling, you know, like we're rolling towards the ending. It's more exciting. But the first one was just tough. But the visuals, like probably like half an hour into the movie, I thought, oh, so I guess Charlie Kaufman saw Ida and got really hyped up. And Ida is a movie by a Polish filmmaker Pavel, last name I can't remember off the top of my head, and he also made Cold War, which is also very good. Turns out it's the same cinematographer, you know. So it's so like just the framing of it is very beautiful. And if you want to see two of the most gorgeous movies you'll ever see in your life, see Ida and see Cold War. And they're just so beautiful. And the way that Lucy's head is framed, like directly in the center of frame, a lot of times or a handful of times throughout this movie, is just so prevalent in Ida specifically, and to a lesser extent, Cold War. But like, I love the movie. Like, I think it's a beautiful movie that just uses green screen a little too much for my liking, you know. And I think it's a very clean sort of cinematography style. I don't find that a lot of I think the camera moves when they do them are the motivation for them is pretty obvious in the dialogue that's happening, you know, as Lucy is at the dinner table talking about how she feels like an infinite amount of time is passing or whatever, as the camera sort of dollies over and uses the wall to reveal her as the only person in frame, and the rest of, like, the other three people are cut out, and then we cut to her sitting at the table by herself, you know. Like, that's a pretty that's a nice motivated camera movement that, like, I don't think needs explanation, you know. But I just think that runs all throughout the movie. It's just a really well-made movie that I wish used fewer green screens, or like one less green screen I guess, but repeat it. But yeah, like all the stuff at the school. I was talking to a friend of ours, Josh, who texted me about this movie and was like, "As after you watch this movie, you need to text me and tell me what you thought about it." And I told him, I was like, "Yeah, I wasn't all the way there." And then basically, once you get to the high school, that movie becomes very much for me, a dream ballet inspired by Oklahoma, and the end speech that he gives at the podium, that Jake gives at the podium, that makeup, the fact that, like, I hadn't seen A Beautiful Mind until 2 days ago, and I think, like, I kind of knew that was from A Beautiful Mind anyway. And it was just like, it's so perfect, because also the choice of A Beautiful Mind for his speech, like so the idea of that him giving a speech is that he has lived a full life. He has a woman who loves him in the crowd. His mother watches on from the physical representation, a physical representation of his childhood home. His father is also in the audience beaming. The idea is that he has lived a full life, and towards the end of his life, he gets recognition, you know, which is just like this grand, like, thank you for living and existing and doing things with your life, or just
Big,
doing
big one.
anything. Exactly, yeah. And that's it is the ending of A Beautiful Mind. Russell Crowe does not sing a song at the end of A Beautiful Mind, but like, and A Beautiful Mind is famous, like, I think at this point is more famous for fudging the numbers on John Nash, who the movie is about, on his life story than anything, in that the screenplay written by Akiva Goldsman used the biography of the same name. I forget the woman's first name, but her last name is Nassar, who wrote it. And they just sort of were like, yeah, we just kind of used it for inspiration, you know. And then we sort of did the and we just ignored the things that didn't play into the things that we wanted to focus on, which is the idea of him being a genius. Certainly a lot of representation of mental health. Those were the two bases. Like the things that they built A Beautiful Mind on. And the thing that is absolutely the through run, or the thing that matters the most in this movie to Ron Howard, who's the director of A Beautiful Mind, is the romance between Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly, which is so movie romance and so hilariously, we're trying to win an Oscar in 2002, like all the way through. And they did, you know, it worked. Just the idea that it all builds to this speech where he doesn't give, like, Jake doesn't give the same word for word speech. Like, his beginning is a little bit different from what John Nash says at the end of A Beautiful Mind. But after that, it's word for word, you know, like, it's amazing. And the makeup in A Beautiful Mind is so hilariously bad. I don't know, I'm watching it 20 years later, and I'm watching it after seeing I'm Thinking of Ending Things. But I think you certainly know I don't have a strong opinion of Ron Howard filmmaker. But it's just like the idea that it's this absolute bending of reality of a true, like a person's real story.
Yep.
They leave out another marriage. They leave out the fact that John and Alicia were divorced for 30 years and then got married again in 2001. They just leave out all of the ugly things about John, or not all of the ugly things, but the ugly things that weren't convenient to the story that they wanted to tell for mass audiences. And
Right.
that's also, that's the story that Jake ended up watching. And that's the story that Jake ended up remembering on his deathbed, apparently, as he gives his fake or gives his speech. And it's just like, it's so beautiful because that is a movie that made so much money. It was so widely acclaimed. It won the biggest prize in Hollywood. And it's just like,
Bullshit.
exactly, it's
Yeah.
bullshit. And it just sort of creates a person like Jake who then creates the interior world of this movie. And I think the other thing that
Rejects anything interior about Lucy that doesn't fit with his internalized notion of romance or a smart man to be recognized or whatever.
exactly, and it's almost like it feels like repetition of movies that came before it. And I think something that's notable about Oklahoma's involvement in this, in I'm Thinking of Ending Things, is that it's a very old musical that is just put on years and years and years, like over and over again. It's like these students are new teenagers, like they're growing up, like they've been born years, decades after Oklahoma, but they're still recycling the same beats. They're still doing the same musical. And that's what A Beautiful Mind is to another extent. It's not an actual remake of another prestige picture from 1986 or whatever. But
Yeah.
it kind of is, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing that really brings all this together, and I think sort of fully like ties into my thinking about everything in this movie being interior to Jake and Jake looking out on the world, is that when he's in his truck, the janitor's in his truck and he's sort of, I don't even know what to call it, having a seizure, heart attack, whatever we're calling that. And what he sees his memory on, the windshield of his car, it turns into a screen. You know, it's not even a window to look out anymore. It's just that screen that shows the Tulsi Town advertisement.
Yeah, you're like
And
a inside a little media box.
exactly. And then the pig leads him inside where he gives his big speech and sings a song and whatever and dies. And just and Charlie Kaufman's. And the other thing that is important to mention is that he's being led by a pig. And that sort of ties us to believe that Jake is a pig. What are pigs on Earth to do? They're here to consume. Consume, 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 and never stop consuming. And that
And
is,
then be
sorry.
consumed.
Exactly, and that's the thing. Like the virus eventually took him over, right? Like he's consuming all of these things, and then eventually the maggots, the virus eats him. You know, and I think the idea is that consumption is great to a point, and then it sort of turns you into Jake. You know, and that's essentially as bad as being eaten by maggots and dying. You know, like and that's my reading on I'm Thinking of Things. You know, and there's so much in the movie, but it all comes back to, I think, the idea of somebody just consuming a lot of things and it sort of warping their view of the world and turning them into a net negative for the world.
Yeah, it seems like he has in that scene where they first get to the barn and he's describing what happened to Lucy, and it's this awful story about the maggots eating this pig and going unnoticed for this long time. He seems to be aware of the gravity of how gross that is. You know, he doesn't want to tell Lucy at first because it's truly this really unsettling story, and then they go on to eat pork that night, which adds another layer to that. But it seems like he saw this as something, you know, he says life is brutal on the farm sometimes or something like that, that this was something that happened here because that's part of agriculture and it's this tough thing. But it seems like by the time he follows the pig, by the time that the animated, you know, anthropomorphized pig shows up and communicates directly with old janitor Jake, it seems like he has understood that that is not exclusive to the farm. Like he, you get this notion that this was this kind of horrific thing that happened to Jake and kind of traumatized him early on, and maybe he's isolated that as that's how things are on a farm, and that's awful. It seems like by the end he has come to terms with that as being beyond the farm and that being life for some people. And it's still, I mean, because he's kind of always Janitor Jake in this film, that moment that he is kind of going off on a steering wheel and saying, all of this is a lie, that age is just a number, that everyone's going to find somebody someday, and kind of all these other lies that maybe Hollywood and media in general has people internalize. That seems to be his understanding of why he, I'm going to say, kills himself at the end. There's just this understanding that things aren't going to get better. And I don't know what it is exactly that set off that understanding, but it seems like that's why he ends his own life. And he goes out in this fantasy where he thanks everybody for recognizing this great person that he is and everything he's done for humanity in a John Nash sense. But that seems to be delirium near the end of his life. And I just totally read that, like that late appearance of the pig is him, that coming full circle, that this awful thing in his childhood wasn't just something that is isolated in his childhood, isn't just because you grew up on a farm, you had this bad experience. As you said, like he's consumed, 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 and then ends up being slaughtered, ends up being something else to be consumed and totally unhappy.
Yeah, I do think I think the very ending is more hopeful. I don't think he dies. I think I actually think the movie ends on, like, I think the first hopeful note in the movie might be the last note of the movie, in
The car
that,
starting?
yeah, exactly. It's at least an attempt to, what's a car, like, even if you're just trying to start a car, you're trying to move forward, and whether or not you succeed, it's a willingness to realize that where you are isn't, metaphorically in Jake's perspective, Janitor Jake's perspective is like realizing that
Want to
where,
be.
sorry,
Not where you want to be.
exactly, he's not where he wants to be, sort of has, it's almost like the person who looks out the window and fabricates a world. It's like he's trying to turn on the car to drive away from that person, and I think the movie ends more hopefully, but I also think it, nobody is incorrect to think that Jake kills himself at the end of this movie.
Yeah, no one's wrong by thinking this might be a bummer of a movie.
Yeah, exactly. No, nobody's wrong to think this Charlie Kaufman movie ends in suicide,
Right. Well, do you want to talk about the dance sequence a bit, or do you want to? We can end on that super, super positive note.
Put dream ballets in everything. I don't know. Like I don't have much to say about it, unless you do.
I mean, it's an extremely wild choice. It was a very weird choice for the film Oklahoma as well. I mean, that's from the 40s. That seems like a very
1950s. 55.
The film.
Yes, the film is from 1955. Yeah.
Yeah, the musicals
Oh,
before,
okay.
but anyway.
I don't see stage plays as real things. I have to look, I have to watch my culture in a window, a windshield of a truck.
No, it's just it. I mean, the idea that that musical itself is one of the early examples of sort of a musical that had all its story, all its songs incorporated into the story instead of just a play that had a couple musical numbers that might be, fun to watch people dance or funny because of some gags that are in it. That the songs themselves were meant to elicit some emotional response. Especially back then. I mean, that was what, almost 70 years ago now. Is really wild. And just that these artistic statements that are such vast departures from reality. Plays are already not reality, but the idea of people singing their feelings and having these choreographed dance numbers that are, you know, diegetic, you know, that make sense within this world, is such a departure. And that this movie that we're talking about that bears so little resemblance to reality, it doesn't even have an internal logic, let alone one that lines up with the exterior world that we're used to. I think it's really telling as an example, and for this, for that movie then, and for this film now, to have this just wildly subjective dance sequence, I think is incredible. I think it's a very, very late curveball in a movie that's already pretty weird. Mm-hmm. And the just even something small like them closing the lockers as they dance, speaks to a very Kaufman thing of trying to right the wrongs through art. And I think that he tries to do that, and I think that Jake is trying to do that sort of in an ugly way, kind of getting away from reality and replacing it with media that he consumed in his earlier life, and calling that a replacement for a real life, and expecting the romantic partners in his life to adapt to that, because that's been the understanding that he has, and to not you know, respect their individuality and interiority, I think is really interesting. And it's also just a very fun dance sequence, like the veil falling from the sky and landing on her head, and the blood napkins coming out after he's been stabbed. It's so separate from reality, and I think in a movie that is very upfront about the fact, you know, in speaking about, when she's speaking about her paintings to his parents, the idea of communicating emotions through what a field looks like, or, you know, imagining yourself in this position, even if you can't see a human, even if the piece of art that you're looking at doesn't look anything like your personal experience, that there's still something to be gained from it. There's still emotional experiences that are of value in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think is a really big swing that works. And I think it turns off a lot of people at that point and makes even less sense. But I think it makes a lot of emotional sense in a spot that is a big pivot point for this movie, and just takes so many of the things that have been kind of poked at and kind of goes for the fences with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. It's a fantastic sequence. But yeah, that's all I've got. You got anything else?
Toni Collette's fantastic.
Hot and, take.
Yeah. Charlie Kaufman's a genius filmmaker, and yes. I like the colors.
Okay, now we'll close with me singing a song from Oklahoma.
the long one.
Yeah, exactly. After having won a Nobel Prize in 1994, the representation of me didn't actually give an acceptance speech for. But yeah, thanks for listening to MacGuffin Ben, and check back next time.